Welcome to Tackling the Opioid Epidemic with the Prescription Playbook, a conversation about empowering and educating communities to prevent overdoses and end the opioid crisis. My name is Paul Abraham, and I'm a prevention specialist with the Prescription Playbook, and I'll be your host today. We're excited to have Dr. Sterling Elliott here from the Feinberg School of Medicine at Northwestern University. Thanks for joining us, Sterling. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing great. Thanks for having me today.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. We're excited to have you. Your work really lines up with what we're doing here. So it's great to have you help us spread this message right now.
Oh, it's terrific. Listen, I think it's great that you guys are an avenue to spread the message because it's one that needs to be talked about as often and as frequently as we possibly can.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think definitely having the message in the air constantly is one of the most important things in this field. But to start us off, I'd love to hear about your background and just how you came to be working in the field that we're in.
You know, I'm a pharmacist. A long time ago, before I got into pharmacy, I worked in and around the sports world, doing some broadcasting, doing, believe it or not, some agent work. Especially with the agent work, I got into representing professional athletes for a little bit. They were young professional athletes trying to make it, but nonetheless, and so I had a familiarity with a lot of those issues. And as you know, as I went through my pharmacy career, you never know where these things take you, but eventually it's taken me to working in and around the area of pain. And you know, with pain comes the opioids. It's the two are intimately connected. I think over the years, I came to realize that America clearly was grappling with a horrible problem here, right? I mean, the opioid crisis has been talked about. The scope of the problem is, you can't avoid. And I think I came to realize that there were probably elements of the problem and elements of the crisis that were simply unmet. And so I started to think about different ways and new ways to approach it. And one of the things that really kind of hit me is that I thought America would benefit greatly, especially surgical patients would benefit greatly from understanding what their tools are and how to use them and how to think about them and make the right decision. And then how to understand when you no longer need it. And so we kind of put a lot of that together and it's just sort of grown from there.
Wow. That's super interesting. Hearing you search out a needed avenue to work in during the opioid crisis is really not only inspiring, but it's a great plan for your research, honestly, finding a way to
sure
really make the most of that and make your research as meaningful as possible. That's terrific. You did get into the history of the opioid crisis and pharmaceuticals a little bit. Could you expand a little bit on the history of the opioid and prescription drug diversion and how that's kind of played into pharmaceuticals and how it's led to our situation now?
Oh, sure. I mean, the CDC paints a picture of it. There's whenever I speak and we kind of talk about the problem and we set the scene for what's the problem and what are we trying to address, I always show a graphic representation that comes from CDC. And their latest update now has a period of time from 1999 to 2021 where they've seen data. And, in that time, the death toll stands at a little more than 645,000 Americans. Yeah. In that 21-year period, right? And when you look at it, you see, they call it three waves, right? And early on, it was prescription opioids. And toward the end of the first decade in the 2000s, we start to see a shift to things like heroin. And then most recently, we're seeing a shift to what they call the fully synthetic opioids. That's particularly things like fentanyl, right? So we've come to the point in time where in 2022, which is last year, we've seen aggregated data. It's about 82,500 Americans died from an opioid overdose. The total overdose number approaches 110,000. And that's from drugs that are not, opioids as well. But within that, 82,500 Americans roughly dead from opioids. And what's really scary is that more than 82% of those opioid deaths, the agent that was found on autopsy was fentanyl, which is a highly potent synthetic opioid. And fentanyl's got a really tough history to it, because like many things, it can do a lot of good, but it can obviously do a lot of harm. And that's been poisoning the drug supply, the illegitimate drug supply, for years now, and it's powering the current phase of the epidemic. But if you look back at it, like we said, it starts with prescription drugs, and it starts with the point where, as a healthcare community, we started to look at pain for patients and started to think about the idea that we really needed to act on pain, that it wasn't just enough to say, well, you're in pain, you got to suck it up.
Right.
With that came some changes in approach from the pharmaceutical companies that made the opioid pain relievers, and changes in approach from the community that clinically used them, right? And so we really tried to get to a point where we were minimizing the impact of pain, and that came with an increased use in opioids. We've heard the stories, we've seen some of the media depictions of, the opioid makers kind of pushing people in that direction. And certainly there's a role in that. In the end, what it comes to is it comes to the idea that Americans are simply consuming more and more opioids. And then there come these new avenues. I think many of us have heard about the pill mills, which popped up all over the country. There were parts of the country where they were particularly active, and those were places where people could see a doctor, get a prescription, and then walk 25 feet to what was set out to be a pharmacy and get their supply of opioids. Like anything else, there were people that needed it, and there were people that needed it as an increased amount of product to sell on the illegitimate market. And so we saw some of that, and that's what powered that initial. What ends up happening is people use opioids. As a responsible clinician, you're saying, I can't keep you on this much for that long. And so you start to try and work to get people down. But if people have become minimally dependent on these things, which means you need them to be able to get through the day, or addicted, in which case there's that dependence issue, but they're going to go out and do whatever they need to get it. Many people started doing that, and they started going to street corners and buying heroin. So that's where we get to the heroin part of it. And then eventually the illegitimate drug supply sort of takes hold, and now fentanyl becomes available in a number of different forms, especially with the rise of the internet as an illegitimate marketplace, the dark web we hear about. Fentanyl was bought and sold on the dark web. People who were trafficking in drugs were using it and adding it to their drug supply. And that's kind of how we get to the point where we are today, where fentanyl is powering the epidemic.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think that really is the driver right now. And that honestly leads me into exactly what I wanted to speak about next. I was hoping that you could speak a little bit about counterfeit pills, a little bit about the prevalence of those and the prevalence of fentanyl in those, in addition to what you were just speaking on.
Oh, sure. I mean, the present day status of the illegitimate drug market is that it's so widely available. And Ann Milgram is the reigning director. She's the current director or administrator of DEA, the Drug Enforcement Administration. And I'll bet you now it might almost be 2 years ago. She attended a summit in Washington, D.C., that was held for families who were grieving the loss of other members from drug addiction. And at one point, she made the audience take their cell phones out of their pocket, right? She said, hold up your cell phone, look at it in your hand right now. If you have your cell phone in your hand, you have a drug dealer in your hand. So we've really seen a lot. Yeah, we've seen the internet, and we've seen social media sort of be corrupted in a way, as a means to easily move product. And with money being able to exchange hands electronically, that means that you know, it becomes much easier for people to pay for these things. You're not hearing the stories as much of the meetings in the dark alleys and things like that. So we're seeing this whole supply, and that's how the market's changed, right? And that's how the marketplace has changed. And we talked about it, the, you know, the rise of the dark web as a means to sell, to trade in illegitimate products has really, I mean, fentanyl has become a staple of that. Initially, we saw fentanyl coming in from overseas markets directly. DEA worked with some of the foreign governments. And so you don't see as much fentanyl coming in as fentanyl, but you do see the raw ingredients, the chemical components that are coming through. And what we know now, my colleagues in DEA that I talk to a lot tell me that, you know, the predominant way that fentanyl is moving in is it's moving in through our foreign borders. The Mexican cartels are known to be trafficking a lot of this in there. Many of them have manufacturing facilities in their locations, and they're manufacturing things that look like other drugs that people want to buy on the market. And in actuality, it's tainted with fentanyl.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, that's one of the most terrifying things I think that we deal with in this industry, people buying a substance that they think is one thing and really finding that fentanyl that's so dangerous, you know, that instead.
There's no question. I mean, you know, the DEA right now readily points to a number. They say that they estimate that 6 of every 10 doses bought in the illegitimate marketplace on the street are tainted with fentanyl.
Wow, that is
So there's a 60% chance that if you buy something on the street from somebody you don't know, and on the street I guess can be a term in quotes at this point, right? Because that also means that electronic marketplace that we were just talking about, 60% shot that there's some fentanyl in there, and there may be enough in there to kill you.
Absolutely, and I think the legitimacy that a legitimate looking pill, you know, adds to someone's thought process when they're taking a drug is really dangerous. They see a pill that might look like something that they would get from you or from a pharmacy, and instead it's from Lord knows where with who knows what in it.
That's there's no question.
Sure. Yeah. So could you speak a little bit to what you would consider the best practices as far as safe use, storage, and disposal of prescription medications, what we can do to kind of be safe when using?
No, sure. I mean, I think don't ever take a pill unless there's a reason to do it. You're injured. There's pain. You've seen somebody who's helped you evaluate that injury, understand the kind of pain that's going on, and prescribed it to you. And, you know, I think it's important for people in general to understand that we always hear people say, well, my pain tolerance is this, or I have a low pain tolerance, or I have a high pain tolerance. I mean, you hear that a lot. And it's a good concept to have, but I think in general, what I always tell people is when you have pain, don't worry about how bad it feels so much. The first thing you should do is ask yourself, is it impacting my ability to do the things I need to do? And when we talk to patients that are having surgery, we give them some criteria for how to do that. And if the pain isn't impacting your ability to move through the day in whatever way you need to, then the opioid is really never your tool. The opioid is there to kind of put up a mask in your brain that helps your brain not understand just how intense the pain is, and then you can move through it. But if you know the pain isn't preventing you from doing that, then that's where I always tell people, you ask yourself, what does the pain feel like? Because that can often tell you whether you need something like an anti-inflammatory or whether something like Tylenol could be really helpful. So I think those are important. And the other thing I think that's really, really critical is that when you get through that painful event and the pain is no longer an issue that you're dealing with, In all likelihood, the hope is that if you've had a prescription for some of those opioid pain pills, you're still going to have a supply left in your cabinet. When that happens, it's important to get rid of it. It's important to get it out of the house. There's ways that you can do it. DEA has their National Prescription Drug Take Back Day program, which I spend a lot of time working with them on. That usually happens the end of every April and the end of every October. And I know we've worked together, and you guys put out the word on that too, which is always great, right? You always got to get the message out. DEA also now has these kiosks that are out there in a lot of places. You see them in pharmacies, you see them in public buildings, fire stations, police stations, city halls, hospital buildings a lot of times have them. And there's website tools that can let you put your zip code in and figure it out. And you can find those things, but it's important to get them out, right? I'll talk about this stuff on television and radio sometimes with people. And whenever we have that conversation, I always tell people, you think of it this way. Opioids are your umbrella when rain is falling on you and it's pain that's preventing you from doing what you need to do, right? So once the storm goes away, you don't need that umbrella. Get rid of it. And if it happens again, we'll get you a different umbrella. And I always like to think about it that way.
That's tremendous. I really like your question about whether the pain is affecting your daily life, affecting the
Yeah.
things you do. That's a great standard for whether the opioids are necessary. And I think something even immediately when you said it, I think it's something that I could even apply in my life. You know what I mean? Is this a pain that is really affecting my life, or is this just a pain I'm feeling? You know what I mean? That's kind of a tremendous idea that I would have never thought about.
Oh, I think it absolutely is. We've for a long time we've focused on intensity, and I think many patients are familiar with how's your pain 1 to 10, right? You hear that asked a lot. First of all, that's not the right way to do it, right? The scale is how's your pain 0 to 10. And I always tell when I speak, even when I speak to healthcare providers, I always tell them, if you ever walk by a room, you hear it all the time. How's your pain? People ask, right? So we're conditioned that 10 scale, right? But the proper way to do it is, Paul, let me ask you about your pain. On a scale of 0 to 10, where 0 is no pain at all and 10 is the worst pain you could imagine, what's your pain level? You hear the difference,
Absolutely,
right?
absolutely.
Because that pain scale is it doesn't have a defined increment, right? Like, we don't know really what the difference is between a rating of 2 and a rating of 3 and a rating of 7. It
Absolutely.
all matters to what Paul thinks. It matters what Sterling thinks. It matters what Abby Lee thinks, right? But there's no way to guide it. There's no way to know it. And so when you start assigning intensity to pills, that's another way people get in trouble, where if you start to think about, is the pain impacting my ability to function? If it is, you've got pain that needs some significant attention. If it isn't, you've got pain that might need attention, but it may not rise to the level that requires something like an opioid. Yes, an opioid's got benefit. There's no question about it. But like everything else in life, everything comes with a cost, right? And the cost of using something like an opioid is the need to be judicious so that you don't get yourself in trouble. And worst of all, so that you don't get yourself in trouble in a way that you never intended, right? That's really one of the concerning things, is that you get people that are finding themselves in trouble who never really had any intention. And that's where they look and they go, oh my God, I got a problem.
Absolutely. That's a
Yeah.
terrifying problem to slip into, especially like you said, unintentionally. That's quite the situation. Does kind of lead into my next question. What are some common barriers you find when trying to educate people to be more responsible with opioids? And what are the barriers in the community towards people being more responsible, towards people being able to?
Well, I think the first barrier is fear. I think these things are scary. I think that they're scary because of their obvious history, right? I mean, you can't walk away from it. They're scary because what people know is that they're the subject of a problem. Are they a subject of a problem? Yes, absolutely. I'm not here to question that, right? But I think that we don't always want to tackle fear if we don't really understand the best way to do it. And so I think that one of the barriers is finding a way to help people better understand how to use those tools, right? And we see it when we talk to our patients, because what we do with our patients in the surgical environment is something that's really unique. I mean, you don't find it a lot, even when you go have surgery with other providers. And very often we see people look at us we usually try to spend about, 8 or so minutes with a patient in the pre-op room before they're going to roll back into surgery. And for about the first 2 minutes or so, you sort of see them looking at you like you may have three heads. And then all of a sudden they realize that they're getting something that nobody's really ever talked to them about, right? Because I think, and this is sort of what, coming back to what we talked about earlier, this is sort of what powered my idea here, is that, we've been talking about the problem for a long, long time, right? We've been talking about the problem of drug addiction and drug abuse and misuse in America, really since the early 1980s. I mean, Nancy Reagan, over the years has taken a beating for Just Say No, it doesn't work. Look, did Just Say No drop the numbers? No, it did not. But it did get America talking about this in a way that we never did before, right? Before the 1980s in America, when there was a drug problem, everybody locked it away. I think there's vestiges of that, not as much as it was. I mean, the drugs, Just Say No, drugs are bad. It opened up the public conversation. But I still think that in the end, people look at drug abuse and drug addiction as a problem they don't want to encounter. Sure. Agreed, you don't want to encounter it. But if it's there and when it's there, what are you going to do? Are you going to continue to allow it to persist, or are you going to try to solve it, right? And I think now one of the big barriers is that in America, we're still focused on talking about the problem. We need to pivot our focus to talking about solutions, right? Which to me is one of the big reasons why when you guys said, will you do this with us? Yeah. I said, sure, because I think this was an opportunity to talk about solutions. And you can see we have today, but we're scratching the surface. I mean, we need to keep talking about solutions. We don't talk about solutions to the opioid issue enough. We talk about the problem. But the numbers, I told you what those numbers are. When you look at that graph, Paul, that graph sort of goes up in what, mathematicians call an exponential pattern, right? Sort of starts out as this line and then it just spikes up at about 2014 when you see the numbers. We're talking about the problem incessantly. Is it doing anything to the death toll? No, it's not. It's the death toll keeps going this way. Till the death toll goes that way, we got a lot of work to do.
Absolutely. Well, that definitely leads me to what I would call the most important topic that we're going to talk about tonight. What message would you send out to both people working in prevention like myself and also just community members listening here in regards to both, the safe use and disposal of medications, but also in as to what they can do to really slow down, hopefully stop this opioid crisis and all the effects that we've been feeling for so long?
Yeah. Well, I think, we've talked about the issues of safe use and safe handling, right? And I think in our heart of hearts, we all know that. It's important to keep talking about it. I say this all the time, and I think I may have just said it a few minutes ago, but we don't talk about it enough.
Right.
This is probably, first of all, if you want to solve this problem, it's probably a conversation that needs to be had many, many days of a 7-day week with the American public, right? And we're ways away from doing that. So I encourage anybody to have the conversation as often as you can. I think it's important to understand that these things have a utility. There's a reason they're there. They are not purely agents of evil. But they are tools that have to be handled correctly and effectively, right? Are there people that are going to get in trouble with them? You better believe it. That's going to happen. And I think it's important to talk about recognizing the signs, changes in behavior, changes in people's approaches to the things they normally do, right? Looking at those kinds of things, I think it's really important to figure that out. And the other thing I think that's really important in 2024 and going forward, and we haven't talked about it yet, but now's the perfect time to do it, is the idea that we need to be, as a public, for lack of a better term, arming ourselves with naloxone a lot more extensively, you know, than maybe we have. And I've in the last couple of years of my work in this field, I've sort of moved into spending a lot of time championing that. And we do that now along with when we work alongside DEA, when we host them at our Northwestern medicine facilities. We're, you know, we're handing out Narcan, and it's I think a fascinating thing to do because it's such a powerful tool. And it'll save lives, right? And you can't really turn the tide of the opioid epidemic until you motivate people to do so, right? And when someone's in the throes of a problem, if you can find a way to get them help before they get to the point of a near deadly overdose, you know, that's the best way to do it. No questions asked. But for that group of the population that's going to keep pushing and pushing the use to a point where they do find themselves in an overdose situation, Narcan is your tool. You can be there. You can prevent them from dying. And if you can do that, you can get them into a scenario where at some point we get them through the trauma of the overdose. And then somebody can come in there and have that conversation and say, this stuff almost killed you. Are you ready to get help? Because if you are, we'll find a way to put you on that path. And I think that's a really important tool because the more we get people better, the more they can go out there and talk about getting better. And I think the power of the message of hearing getting better is really important.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I definitely appreciate you meeting with us today. Was there anything you'd like to leave us with? Any other information we didn't go over that you'd like to give to our listeners?
You know, I think the big thing is, because I know your listeners, a lot of our listeners are going to be families and high school athletes. That's a big group of people that you talk to. And that's a group, you know, that's a group where these issues can arise. And I think what's important is to make sure that we're thinking about these issues as a tool, right? Injuries are going to happen. You want to play sports, injuries are going to happen. When those injuries happen, we want to make sure that we're doing everything we can to take care of our athletes, right? And I think, you know, that's a huge issue because within that realm, that's a group where there's often forces pushing people to work through painful events, right? We always hear, you got to play with pain. Okay, you do. Now, but is playing with pain mean masking the pain? And the answer to that is, I don't think it is. But it's a matter of how do you deal with it effectively? And so I would say for this audience, that's an important thing to think about.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a great food for thought. I think a lot of things that were said today are things that we could take and think about, especially regarding prescription medication safety. So I definitely thank you for coming to speak with us. And we'd just like to thank everybody who's listening and joined us in the fight to end the opioid epidemic. For more information on how we can work together to raise awareness on the epidemic, you can find us at ilhpp.org/prescription-playbook, as well as on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook.